At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And there's a new documentary that's been killing it, literally, on the festival circuit this past year. It's called The History of Horror and Metal, and it's directed and produced by Mike Schiff. I'm actually in it as well. I first met Mike when he worked on Fozzy's video for Sandpaper way back in 2012. You hear some of the great stories from that shoot coming up. And Mike is a horror and metal fan, decided to do this documentary about the deep connection and roots between heavy metal music and horror films. Mike did over 60 interviews. He talked to a who's who of the horror genre, from Gunnar Hansen from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Kane Hodder, of course, Jason Voorhees, John Carpenter, Bela Lugosi's son. He also talked to some of the biggest names in heavy metal as well, Kirk Hammett, Alice Cooper, Corey Taylor, Scott Ian, Chris Jericho. You hear what inspired this movie, what Mike thinks about the connection himself, some of his faves in metal and horror, and who he really wanted to speak with but wasn't able to get for the documentary. The doc has won a bunch of awards and should be available early next year for everyone to see. Info will be posted at metalhorror.com. And speaking of metal, Fozzy just wrapped up a great run of dates in Europe. Shows are incredible. The entire tour was sold out. Thanks to everybody who came and rocked with us. And the Save the World Tour is headed out again in March, doing another round of dates in the States, and this time we're headed to the West Coast as well. We start March 31st in Detroit and hit California starting May 5th in L.A. at the world-famous Whiskey A Go-Go. Tickets are available at FozzyRock.com. We're doing our legendary, much-anticipated, much-requested legendary VIP meet-and-greet. It's the best of the biz. Get your tickets now at FozzyRock.com. Of course, we play a mini set of songs for you. We hang out, we meet you, we greet you. We have a great time. Once again, get your tickets and VIPs at FozzyRock.com. All right, The Rock continues now with director Mike Schiff and the history of horror and heavy metal, the documentary, right here on Talk is Jericho. This is actually a pretty cool topic because this has been a long time coming. We're talking to Mike Schiff here, who's the director of the history of metal and horror. I like a movie that tells you exactly what it's about right out of the gate. It's the history of metal and horror. But the thing is, we've known each other for a long time, and we'll get into this, but seeing this movie, you've been working on this for a long time, and I can tell because I'm in it with short hair.
Yeah, exactly.
How long has this been going on?
Oh, man, started in 2014. It's going way back. So it's been close to 7 years I've been working on this.
So that just goes to show too, for people who are listening that don't know a lot about the actual art of filmmaking, it takes a long time to make a movie sometimes, like you mentioned, 7 years to do this documentary. And it seems almost like a no-brainer because there's such a connection between heavy metal and horror movies. But why did it take you 7 years to get this done?
A lot of reasons. So yeah, it's I wasn't working with a huge production company. I was pretty much doing most of the work myself, with some help, you know, with my friend Robert Lucas, who is also a producer on the film, and he was very well connected in the metal and horror world. So he was able to really help get this thing started. But yeah, it's hard raising funds. I did raise some, but it's always a little bit of a struggle. So it was raising money, but then it was also you know, we're not just setting up a studio somewhere and having all the interviewees show up and saying, hey, here's a schedule. And then you could just bang out all the interviews in 1 month. It's like everyone's donating their time. So we kind of work around their schedules. So if someone like you, for example, I mean, you know, you were the first interview that we did.
Really?
Yeah. And you guys, I think you guys were performing at the Gramercy in New York. So I saw that you guys were lined up for that. So I reached out to you because you and I knew each other prior to that. And I asked you if you could, you know, do our first interview. And you gave your time to give us a great one to start with. So, yeah, so it was a lot of that. It was a lot of just kind of waiting for the right moment where someone was available, you know, and sometimes we'd work it out with management where we'd fly out to a person's house or to wherever, you know, like Dave Mustaine had us at his house. Alice Cooper had us at Cooperstown at his restaurant. So, you know, a lot of it is just kind of working on scheduling and there's a huge waiting game involved in doing something like this.
So how did you come up with the original concept of it?
So in 2014, my friend Rob and producer had invited me to Kirk Hammett's Fear Festival convention in California. And he knew Kirk and he knows a lot of people that were involved and invited there. So he brought me on board to do some videotaping, some photography, and just kind of help out and hang out and kind of have a good time and do a little work. So after that, basically what Kirk's convention was just like huge combination of metal and horror people, you know, the stars of heavy metal, stars of horror, brought it together into this one weekend. And afterwards, I turned to Rob and I said, hey, you know, has there ever been a documentary made on why metal and horror work so well together? You know, I mean, we saw this, you know, at Kirk's show. It's like these two worlds collided. So there hadn't yet been a documentary made on the subject matter. So I figured it would be a good time to get one started.
Were you a fan of both?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with horror since I was a little kid. My dad got me started very early on. He was a huge fan of the Universal Monsters. He grew up in that period. And then he got into the Hammer films later after that. And then he got me started when I was a little kid. So very early on, I got into horror. Huge fan as a little kid. I was drawing Freddy Krueger gloves, you know, on my desk in school and all that kind of stuff. And then I didn't really get into metal until later. I was a little slow on that end. I started listening to soundtracks mostly when I was a kid, you know, Lost Boy soundtrack. And then I started buying the score to a lot of horror films, Elm Street soundtracks. And those, of course, you know, started having a lot of rock and metal bands on the soundtracks and everything. So that kind of got me in. And then later in the 90s, I got a little bit more into the metal scene. Then now I can pretty much say I'm a horror and a metalhead.
You know, you know, you're really into it when you buy the soundtracks for the horror movies, but it doesn't even have actual songs on them. Like it was just the actual orchestration.
I know. Well, because I was also doing like short films with my friends back in those days. So I'd get like the, you know, the scores to these films and copy them over into my movies. So I'd have like, you know, a score that I would just copy over.
It's funny because one of the first times I hung out with Eli Roth, I went to his house and he was playing the soundtrack for Fulci's Zombie. And I said, is that the soundtrack for Fulci's Zombie? And he goes, yeah. I said, what is worse? The fact that I just randomly come over to your house and you're randomly playing Fulci's Zombie just for yourself, or the fact that I recognized that it was the soundtrack for Fulci's Zombie.
Yeah, right.
You know, so when you get the idea to do this documentary and you start putting together the ideas, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned you went to Kirk's Festival. He's kind of almost a bucket list guest on Talk is Jericho for me, not only for the Metallica side of things, but of course for the horror side of things as well, because Kirk has a massive collection of horror movie items, trinkets, special effects, props. Did you ever talk to him about that or see some of the stuff that he had?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at both of his shows that he did, 2014 and 2015, I believe, he brings in truckloads of his collection. So he will have life-size Frankensteins and Draculas and all this kind of stuff. It really looks like it's like a museum that he built. And it's all his stuff. And he has old posters, original posters, props, just like an amazing collection of stuff. And a lot of it, you know, he had that book, Too Much Horror Business. So he shows a lot of stuff in that book. I would definitely recommend that for some good reading. But yeah, as it shows, I mean, it was just incredible how much stuff he had there. I can't imagine what his storage unit looks like or wherever he keeps his stuff, because it's a massive, massive, very cool collection.
I went to Tom Savini's house once in Pittsburgh, and he has a similar thing. He's got a lot of his casts and masks and head busts that he's done, but he also collects, you know, horror memorabilia. That's the word I was looking for before, memorabilia. But unlike Kirk, he keeps it all in his house. He's got one of those houses that's got like, you could put it on like junk collectors or whatever it is, like on A&E or something. But every bit of it is cool shit. And he actually, the one thing that I remember the most is if you, I think it was Lost in Space, that show from the 60s. He actually has the real Robbie the Robot.
He does.
It's like as tall as I am, just sitting there. And like, I think his mouth moves or something, or it moves a little bit. And it's like just in his room, like in his living room.
Yeah, it's in his bedroom. Like right, he has got his bed, and then he's got surrounded by, he's just literally surrounded by stuff, you know, like props.
Did you interview Tom for this?
Yeah, Tom's in it. Tom's become a friend over the years, which is another cool thing about working on stuff like this. I mean, when I was a kid, I originally wanted to be a special effects artist, and Savini, Rick Baker and Dick, you know, and all these guys, like, you know, I followed them, and I'd go to conventions, wait in line to get an autograph and stuff. And I remember meeting Tom back in late 80s, early 90s or something like that. But then working along through this process, Tom's kind of become a friend, and I've been to his house a couple of times, and it really is the coolest house. And he grew up in that house. He's been there forever. Yeah, it is. It's very dark. It's very creepy and very cool. But what he would do is he'd go to conventions when he'd do signings and things like that, and he'd always have to buy something at someone's table, and then he'd have to have it shipped, you know, back to his house. So that's kind of how he, over the years, he just collects stuff.
We worked together on the sandpaper video, which I totally forgot about when, like I said, when I watched this, because we talk about the video for a while. And right as I was getting on this podcast, I just went to refresh my memory of what your last name was. And I saw Mike Schiff, and I was like, holy shit, Mike did the camera and directed, you know, co-directed or DP'd that video. So, well, let's talk about it right now. So what do you remember about that? Because this was about 10 years ago or so. And just for people that don't know, we went out into the woods to do a kind of homage to Evil Dead. And the concept of the video was that the band gets possessed, similar to Ash in the first Evil Dead, and we combat the demons and all that sort of thing. And we did it in this little cabin in the woods in somewhere in Georgia or something like that. So how did you get involved with that? What do you remember about it?
Yeah, that was a good time. How that came about, sometime before that, because I worked at the Howard Stern Show for about 7 years, and I'm good friends with Richard Christie, who you, of course, you know, starred with in Albino.
Albino Farm, that's right, yeah.
And so Sean McEwen, who directed, him and I co-directed Richard's second video for Charred Walls of the Damned for Zero Span. So him and I met there. And then one day I just get a call from him saying, hey, I'm working with this band Fozzy, and we need someone to come out to do camera and editing and stuff. And he said, would you be interested? I was like, yeah, man. So he had me come down, and that's when I met all you guys. And then we shot this video, I think over 2 days at this old cabin. I remember it was hot and humid, and it was like kind of swampy and stuff. But it was a really fun shoot. And one story that I love to tell when people ask about it is, I don't know if you remember the moth incident.
I don't. Tell it.
So it was late at night. It was like a last shot, right? And it was at the last scene where all the trees come to life, and they wrap around the band members, and you all get pulled out, you know, out of frame. And so because we had all those big lights out in the middle of the woods, of course, they're attracting all the insects and the moths. And I remember there was a moth, and this is like down south, you know, type insects. And there was a moth that must have had a wingspan of about, you know, 10 or 12 inches. Right? It was like, it was huge. And it was just like coming at us, you know. And I remember, like, you got in its way, and you just started throwing like these punches at it. And it was just like, and everyone just started cracking up, because it was just like Godzilla versus Mothra, you know. And you, it's Chris Jericho, you know, throwing these punches at this giant moth and stuff, not hitting it, but just kind of getting it out of the way. So that was one of the funniest moments that we had
there. I do remember at one point I hit it, and it was solid too. It was like hitting like a piece of cardboard or something, because it was fast. I remember the thing, I do remember that.
Yeah.
I remember it being very humid, like you said. And when you watch it back, like it actually, you know, like what was our budget, you know, $12 or whatever, yeah. but it was actually pretty, it's still pretty good. Cause the reason why I knew that it turned out good was that M Shadows, who sang on the song, actually wanted to be in the video.
Yeah.
I thought at first he'd be like, oh, it's too cheap or whatever. But he actually wanted to be in it. We went out of our way. Sean had to film him on green screen in LA to kind of put him on the TV that was broadcasting the demons. And he kind of came on in this possessed TV or whatever it was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a really cool addition.
I remember too, because we were all putting contact lenses in because we were possessed.
Yeah.
So we had the white contacts. And Rich couldn't, or the guitar player, Rich just could not get him in. I remember he was just trying. He was crying.
If
you're not used to it. And he was just like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I said, well, that's fine. You just put your hair in front of your face. No one will notice anyways.
Yeah. I think we just had to kind of cut around it because everyone else was able to get him in. And I remember I felt so bad for him too, because I put contacts in my eyes too. And it's, if you're not used to it and if you're doing it for the first time, it's like, it's really kind of jarring and,
right.
And stuff. So yeah, I felt terrible for him. So we just have to kind of cut around that a little bit.
You know, what's interesting too, is before the Judas video came out, that one was about almost at 1 million. And I remember I told somebody, like, I hope if Sandpaper did 1 million, I hope Judas can do 3 million. And Judas went through the roof where it's now, I think, at 52 or 53 million. And Sandpaper's up to about, I think, 4 million views now. So
yeah,
people are still checking it out, which is cool. So this is kind of our first foray into making a real music video, so to speak.
Well, the success of the Judas video definitely helped Sandpaper, you know, because once you,
it did,
you know, you see what other videos Fozzy's.
Everything got swept up. The last thing I want to talk to you about Sandpaper is, remember you mentioned that we had the weed and the branches and the trees kind of attack us like Evil Dead. How did you do that? Speed it up, obviously, but how do you film that? Like, what was kind of the secret behind that?
Well, we had a couple of guys go out into the woods prior to filming, and they found a lot of those weeds and vines and things. We sent the guys out, look for some vines that you can just tear off the tree and that we can use. So we wrapped you guys up in the vine, made you kind of struggle with it in the scene, and then kind of pull them. So then we reverse the footage. So then in the video, it looks like, you know, they're actually moving forward instead of backwards. And, you know, just like one of those old, you know, cheap tricks and stuff.
Movie magic. No CGI in the Fozzy videos. Not because we're artists. We just couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
But you, like you said, that led to our relationship. And then I come and do the first interview for you. How hard was it to get some of the names you wanted? Because as we know in Hollywood, usually it's like, when you get one person, you say, well, Chris Jericho's done it. And then suddenly we get Chris Jericho and Kirk Hammett has done it. And then suddenly the ball keeps rolling. So who were some of the major names that when you got them, you were able to attract other people?
Well, Kirk, definitely. You know, having you on board, Kirk. You know, I got Tom Savini on pretty early, Doug Bradley. Corey Taylor was actually was a pretty early one. And I had met Corey a couple of years back when I was still working at the Stern Show. I met him for the first time, and then him and I could kind of run into each other at different events and things like that. So I had met his manager prior to that. So I was able to reach out to her, you know, request the interview and everything. So he already kind of knew me at that point. So it was cool. But yeah, once I had a short list of people already in there, I built the website around it and did a short trailer. And so from there, other people were able to see it as like a legit project, you know, with some big names, and it just kind of kept going on from there. And there were still a bunch of people that I would have loved to have interviewed for this. And I tried really hard, but it just didn't come to fruition for whatever reason. So, but you know, I got an amazing lineup of people. I mean, over 60 interviews in this thing. So I've been very, very lucky to get as many people as I did.
It's funny with Corey. I was just watching a documentary called "In Search of Dark." Is it "In Search of Darkness"?
Yeah,
yeah. The about 80s horror. It was part two, and Corey was in that. So he and I were talking about that probably just, I don't know, 6 months ago whenever we watched it. And then I was just talking to him the other day. I'm like, dude, like we are horror movie documentary sluts. Like I just saw another one that we're both in. He goes, which one? I said, The History of Metal Horror. He goes, I forgot about that one. I said, so did I. I didn't forget about it because you kept mentioning it, but I forgot that I had done the interview so far ago at the Gramercy. So you mentioned that there are some guys that you didn't get that you wanted to. Who were some of those?
I'm always like careful to mention names because I don't want to seem like, you know, I don't want to like throwing anyone under the bus or anything. But yeah, like I worked really hard to try to get Ozzy. And I was working with his manager, who was very cool. It's just a lot of different things happen. You know, Ozzy would have you know, maybe some health issue or something else would kind of come in the way. So there's always a roadblock with Ozzy. I try to get Kerry King. I think he originally wanted to do it, but then just got caught up with stuff. And then Slayer was going through their thing. So, yeah, so it's just a lot of it is not so much that anyone would say no, you know, right away. It's more like, yeah, let's do it. But right now is not a good time. Let's wait a couple of months or whatever. So right. It would just be like, okay, we'll check in a few months. Still not a good time. A couple of more months. Yeah, we still want to do it, but it's not a good time. And then eventually it gets to be such a long period that it just never happens.
Well, you also kind of get the hint too. You can only ask someone so many times before you're like, maybe they aren't into this, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, and it was tricky because there were some interviews like Rob Zombie, you know, I was in touch with his management for about a year and a half. Right. And they were very cool from the start. And they said, yeah, Rob, you know, Rob wants to do it. I think I had texted with him once, actually mentioned it. And he said, yeah, you know, work it out with management. And so we did. But it did take about a year and a half for that interview to actually happen. So those were one of those things where you kind of have to be persistent enough to get it and not give up, because had I given up early on, then I wouldn't have had the interview. But I kept in touch with management. I saw that Rob Zombie was performing in New York. I said, hey, you know, Rob's going to be in town. Is it cool if maybe we head over to the show and then just grab a couple of minutes with them before the show? And they said, yeah, let's do that. So eventually it happened. And Rob was so cool because when we got there, he actually apologized to me. He's like, hey, man, I'm so sorry. It took this long to finally get the interview. And I said, you're a little bit of a busy guy. You got movies going on, albums, tours, all this kind of stuff. I said, it's totally cool, but I appreciate that. So a lot of it is just sort of waiting and getting lucky. And some of it is waiting and nothing happens.
Well, Rob is one of the kind of the cornerstones of what metal and horror is, because he does both. Like he mentions in the documentary how he kind of started creating his own stages and his own videos and then actually doing his own movies. So that's a great guy to have. What do you think of Rob's movies and how they tie in with all of this?
I think they're cool. I think they have what I like about his movies is sort of just the old grittiness to them. There's a certain grit to his films that you don't see in a lot of stuff. So I think that's kind of a cool thing, you know, to kind of just like, you kind of feel dirty, you know, you just kind of feel kind of gross. Like, oh man, it's like you got this dust on your skin after coming out of it. But yeah, I'm interested to see what he does with the Munsters remake that he's working on.
I mean, that would seem that would have much more of a comedy element to it, you would think.
I would imagine so. I'm sure he's trying to stay true to the original as much as possible.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because when I went and saw House of a Thousand Corpses in the theater, I did feel dirty. Now, Devil's Rejects is different because they're a little bit more pop culture heroes at that time. But the first House of a Thousand Corpses, you didn't really know what was going on. Like, what is all of this about? And feel dirty, feel kind of like if this was a wrestling match, the bad guys take the beginning of the match, they take the middle of the match, and then they take the end of the match and they win. The end.
Yeah.
It's like nothing good happens in that movie.
Nothing good happens. No, it's all pain and misery. Speaking of which, I was fortunate enough to have interviewed Sid Haig. I had a lot of good talks with Sid. We had breakfast and lunch a few times, and he was a great storyteller. And we interviewed him probably in about 2015, I think, when he was still himself. And sadly, you know, he passed and years after, you know, year after year after the interview, seeing him, you know, we saw him kind of go downhill health-wise, and it was just really, really sad to see. And Bill Moseley also from the film was interviewed as well. So, you know, I've known Bill for a couple of years now also. That's also part of the process, just building these relationships with people that I've watched in films and their music I listen to and everything.
Was there anybody that was that hard to get, like, any stories behind that? And I'll give you an example. Like, the first time before I really knew Kevin Smith, well, he was going to do Talk Is Jericho, and I was told to go to his house because Kevin likes doing everything in his own studio at his house. And I went to his house. You know, I knock on the door. There's nobody really there. So I get in the car, and I drive away, and I see him walking his dog, and I pull up next to him, and he thinks I'm some kind of a weird fan or something. Like, we're supposed to have an interview? And he's like, what? That's now? Oh, I thought that was, you know, tomorrow or whatever. And I was like, well, he goes, just can you come back later? All right. Like, when? He's like, just later. And I'm like, okay. So I ended up now he and I are really good friends, and we've been on each other's podcast quite a few times. But that was one of those ones where I was like, if this motherfucker's not home later, I'm just going to climb through his window and wait inside his house.
Yeah. I'm sure he wouldn't blame you for that either.
Right, right. Did you have any experiences like that?
No, not really. I mean, I remember, a couple of small funny things would happen here and there. I remember we interviewed, Phil Anselmo, and he was doing his convention, the House Core convention. And so we set up a hotel room like we did for a lot of interviews, and we just set up lights and cameras and everything. So we mentioned to him earlier that we're going to do interviews, and if he'd want to be interviewed, come up to the room whenever he's ready. So he came up. I don't know what he thought initially was going on, because once we opened the door, he kind of peeks in and he looks nervous, like we're doing some kind of snuff film or a weird porno or something like that. He's like, "Oh." And then once he kind of saw some of his people in there, he was like, "Oh, okay." So then he comes in and he sits down. That was a fun interview. He's an intense guy.
I think he was a little bit high, shall we say, in that one, because you could tell by his voice. He's got that super deep voice as it is, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything, but
you don't have to. I saw it.
People can make that. People can judge for themselves once they see it. But he was a trip for sure.
You mentioned, we can go through some of the other people that were in the movies, because you got a lot of great characters in them, and obviously Alice Cooper, who is also a friend of mine. Great guy, another great storyteller, awesome sense of humor. And you mentioned you did that at Cooperstown, which is his restaurant. So what was your experiences with Alice?
That was amazing. And that was an interview that took a while to get going. But yeah.
Why is that?
Just timing. He might have been on tour. He might have been working on other things. So we had this window of opportunity to fly out to Cooperstown and interview him there. And we must have sat down with him for about an hour. And he was just the nicest guy. I mean, everything they say about him is true. He is just like the nicest guy, and just so gracious, so humble. He had ordered food for himself and his family, I guess, from the restaurant. And he was just sitting there probably for about a half an hour. And we're still talking. He's like in no rush to get out of there. He's just having a good time talking to us about horror movies. And that sort of happened a few times. It happened with Corey Taylor as well. We interviewed him before a Slipknot show in Jersey. We had maybe half an hour with him or something like that. They said, you got a half an hour, then we got to get Corey to the next interview, then the show and all this stuff. So I think maybe a half hour in, his tour manager comes in and says, "Hey, Corey, we got to get you to the next interview." He's like, "Hey, man, give me like another 10, 15 minutes. I'm on a roll here." Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it's like a lot of these guys just love talking about horror so much that they will kind of push everything else to the side for a little extra longer to have a good conversation. And being fans of these guys too, like, that's such a cool thing for someone to make extra time for you. Like, that's really awesome.
Well, that's the secret to it too, is you're getting guys who really are interested in this on both sides of the coin. Corey is a perfect example. I've done it with him. You want to talk about Fulci, you want to talk about Gates of Hell, you want to talk about Argento, you want to talk about John Carpenter, what do you got, sort of thing. And that's, I would imagine those are the best talking heads that you could have for your documentary, when you have somebody who's really super interested in these things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's not everyone gets to talk about this stuff, kind of geek out. And if you're hanging out with friends or your spouse or whoever who's just not into it, it's not like a regular conversation. It's like every now and then you'll run into a buddy who's just really into the subject matter, and then you'll just kind of go off and start telling stories. And, we did that too. We did that with a bunch of guys, just started talking about horror films. And that's something I really wanted to bring to this documentary, is just to really show the passion, that all you guys have for horror. So we really focus on, the way the documentary is kind of structured is, it starts out with, first of all, there's a 13-minute short film that is broken up into segments, and each part of the short film introduces the next section. And the short film is hosted by Michael Berryman. The first section of the documentary is really about the history of horror. And it's a very beefy section, because horror goes so far back into history, just like writing hieroglyphics on the walls and paintings, and then getting into books and films and all this stuff. And then we kind of branch into how all the stars, how, you guys were first introduced to horror as a kid. Like, what were your experiences as a child? How did that shape your interest in this genre? And then we get into the history of metal, and then we kind of bring the two together and see how they merged, how a lot of metal guys started bringing horror into their music, into the stage shows and their look and everything. So then we sort of conclude with, you know, why is it that metal and horror work so well together? And then the film concludes everything, and that's kind of the structure of the
film. It was interesting, and something you don't see in other documentaries, which is, like you mentioned, kind of your own little short horror movie intertwined with the documentary. What was the reasoning behind that? Because it is a little bit weird at first. You're like, what is this? It's a documentary, but it starts out in the bunker, and he's the last living human on Earth. And you see Michael Berryman, of course, who we all know from Hills Have Eyes or from the Motley Crue Home Sweet Home video, if that's so inclined in that way. So you see what's going on, but it's very original. You don't see it in most documentaries, if any others at all, that I can think of.
Yeah, I felt that most documentaries that I was seeing were just straight talking heads and B-roll, and which is fine, but I just wanted to do something a little bit different. I wanted to make a little bit more of a theatrical experience. So I did this short film, and basically, without giving too much away on that, it's just about this, it's kind of like a post-apocalyptic world, and this one guy who's remaining, and he finds these cassettes that have like history lessons on them. So he kind of puts them in the machine, and Michael Berryman ultimately appears and starts giving him sort of the history lesson. He's like, now let's talk about the history of horror. Let's talk about the history of metal. And so he's sort of introducing each segment. So he's working as the host. And in some documentaries, you might have a host, you know, who kind of talks to the camera, and it's very straightforward. But I wanted to make him also a character in a film and not just hosted by Michael Berryman and he's just being himself. I wanted him to be a character as well. So yeah, and it was also an opportunity for me to do a short film at the same time, because ultimately what I want to do is do feature horror films. You know, I was able to kind of grease my wheels a little bit and do a documentary, which I was really passionate about, but also kind of do a bit of a film narrative aspect to it as well.
I love it. Great finish with some nice, A+ gore at the end. But you did mention though, Mike, like this is a lot to bite off. Your take on this was explain the history of horror, then explain the history of heavy metal. I mean, that's a lot to tackle in 2 15-minute segments or whatever it may be.
Yeah. And also like the horror section is definitely beefier than the metal as far as the history goes, just because the history is so much longer for horror. And it's really kind of focusing on how horror influenced the musicians. Not so much the other way around, because a lot of the horror guys aren't really metal fans. That's one thing that I also discovered along the way too, is that, you know, you talk to Tom Savini or Doug Bradley or whoever, and you say, hey, you know, like, who are your favorite metal bands? And they'd be like, I don't really like heavy metal.
Oh, wow. So it's not reciprocal.
Yeah. A few of them did, but, you know, a few of them like, yeah, you know, I kind of like Metallica and stuff like that, but it's not the same. You know, the other way around, that's for sure.
Did you learn anything when you were discussing the history of horror? Like, how did you have somebody work with you on that, like a fact checker, or did you just basically just Google it and start doing it yourself?
I Googled. I found Karina Wilson, who is a horror historian and a writer. She's in the film quite a bit. And we sat down with her for probably over 2 hours. And the amount of horror history that she keeps in her brain is incredible. I mean, she remembers dates and names and everything without looking at notes. I mean, it's like she has a computer for her brain, and she's just giving this huge lesson in horror, you know, year after year after year. We also spoke to Del Howison of Dark Delicacies in California. He's also a writer, horror historian. So, we spoke to him. He's a friend of my friend and producer, Rob Lucas. So we were able to get him on board, and he was also able to give a lot of horror history as well. So between the two of them, they were able to kind of get things started. And then everyone else kind of chimed in after that. But they helped build the structure of like the history of horror, which was great, because then it's not just fans of the genre just talking about their favorite movies. It's really getting into actual history of the genre itself, going way, way back in time.
Well, once again, the history of metal and horror, and that's exactly what you tackle. And I thought it was great, too. You found a lot of guests. I keep saying guests. I don't know if that's the proper way to say it. Cast members, contributors.
Interviewees.
Interviewees, yeah. That I've never seen before. Like, and I'm probably getting this wrong, and you can correct me, but relatives, Boris Karloff's granddaughter or whatever, Lon Chaney's grandson, Bela Lugosi's grandson. Talk a little bit about that, because I've never seen these people before.
Oh yeah,
on camera. And it was really cool to see.
Yeah, I was very, very fortunate. And I met them all at Kirk's show, actually. He had them all because he's fans of theirs. So he brought them on board. So, yeah, so we have Sarah Karloff, who's actually Boris Karloff's daughter. We have Bela Lugosi Jr., who's, you know, Bela Lugosi's son. And then Ron Chaney Jr., who is the grandson of Lon Chaney Jr. and, you know, great-grandson of
Lon Chaney Jr. So this is Lon Chaney 3, basically?
Yeah, so there's Lon Chaney Sr., Lon Chaney Jr., and then I guess his dad, Ron, and then he's Ron Jr. So
okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
So he's great-grandson of Lon Chaney Sr.,
right.
Basically. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, and they're all still running their family's industries, you know. They're still doing, you know, Chaney Entertainment or Karloff Enterprises. So they're still keeping the name alive, and they're still appearing at conventions, doing signings and everything. So I was incredibly lucky to get them on board, like the actual descendants of the originators, really, of some of the big monster movies.
Well, those are three of the coolest names ever. Just perfect for horror. Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
What do you think the fascination is with those old Universal monsters? And of course, Universal is the studio that made these movies in the 30s and 40s, black and white. We're talking about the Wolfman, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Mummy, Creature of the Black Lagoon, etc. Why are we still fascinated with them all these years later with all the CGI and all the other special effects that we've seen?
I mean, I think it's an appreciation for what started it all. And I think the same thing goes for music, too. I think a lot of musicians look back on some of the early fans of Black Sabbath, you know, one of the first metal bands, really, who so many people were inspired by. It's different maybe from what we're used to now, but like you can still go back and really appreciate the art form and look back and say, wow, this is sort of what started everything else, you know. It just exploded into this massive industry. And I think there's like a nostalgia for the old stuff. And also, if you're just into, you know, you got some fans of horror who may be looking at those old films like, those are corny, I can't watch that stuff. You know, it's not mm-hmm. loud, it's not bloody, it's not, the acting is cheesy or whatever. But if you're really into history and how film grew and evolved, I think you can look back on those films like, wow, this is what inspired everything else that we're looking at now. I mean, it had to start somewhere. Even though those weren't the first horror films, you know, you had earlier horror films, silent movies and stuff. These are the first big ones, you know. How many Frankenstein movies have been made? How many Dracula movies have been made? I mean, it's just those films really stuck around because they were such great. Even just the original books were so fantastic. You can just keep making a new movie based on those original stories.
Right.
And so they become so classic that you could just keep going. You know, there aren't that many, I don't know how many books are written today where you'll have a film made of it and remade again after that. It's like those original Universals have been made and changed in a lot of different ways over the years. But those characters are what people still kind of go back to every now and then.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, you're talking about the history of horror and you have to get the grandchildren, you know, the descendants of these original characters. But you talk about the history of heavy metal, which basically only started specifically late 60s, early 70s. And you have somebody like Alice Cooper, who not only is one of the first guys to do horror in heavy metal, he's one of the first guys to do heavy metal, period. So I thought that's kind of cool when you're talking about the history and that horror goes back to caveman times. Heavy metal goes back to, you know, I was born in 1970, basically right at the beginning of my life. So when you get someone like Alice out there, because there's so much to talk about from a metal side, the horror side as well. And then even talking about Prince of Darkness and his relationship with John Carpenter, who's also in the movie. I thought that was really cool, too. We've never really seen that before, how Alice even ended up in that movie and how integral he is to both sides of the coin.
And it was great because he told his side of the story from Prince of Darkness, and John Carpenter, who's also in the film, told his side of the story. So I was able to intercut their interviews together to help tell the story, you know, together. So, yeah, I mean, Alice, basically, they were friends and he showed up to the set just to kind of hang out. And John Carpenter just grabbed him and, you know, kind of dragged him in for a small part, and that's how we ended up in the movie.
I saw Prince of Darkness probably only once. I need to rewatch it. But I remember that death and explain what Alice did and where Carpenter got the idea from it. Because he just basically wrote the scene on the spot, right?
Yeah. So John says, I guess Alice had a thing he'd do on stage where he'd take like a part of a bicycle and jam it through someone, or he'd stick something through. He'd impale someone with like a pole or whatever. So John knew about that. So then when they were on set, I guess they had this part of a half bicycle or something like that, where there's a pipe sticking out of it, a bar sticking out of it, whatever. So so Alice, you know, confronts this guy. He blocks him in the hallway, in the alleyway.
Alleyway, yeah.
Right. And then he takes the bicycle stand and just impales the guy with with the bike. So that's how it ended up in the movie, because Alice was doing this type of stuff on stage. So John wanted to bring that into the movie. And that was, it was just like, it wasn't really planned way in advance. It's just something that kind of happened while they were shooting.
How was it that you were able to get John Carpenter? Once again, that's a huge get for the horror, you know, from the horror world.
Yeah, that was a cool one, because again, Rob had brought me on board. Rob has a studio in Burbank.
Zombie?
No, sorry, Rob Lucas, who's producer on the film and good friend. So he worked it out with John to do two of John's music videos, because Carpenter, he was doing, he had a new album coming out, and he wanted to do, he redid Escape from New York and a new one called Distant Dream. So his new musical tracks that he put together. So he wanted two new music videos. So I was brought on board to do second camera, and then I also edited both videos. So we were working with him. Where did we shoot? We shot that at a sound stage, actually, in LA. So we shot it there, and then we came back to the studio. I cut it there, and then when John came over to watch him, he loved both videos, and it was very cool. And kind of throughout that process, we said, hey, you know, we're doing this documentary called The History of Metal and Horror. Would you sit down for a few minutes to do an interview? So because we were working with him on his videos, he was kind of, as a favor, he sat down with us to do the interview for this. Well, so that's kind of how we built that relationship, which was very cool.
How was he as the interview?
He was cool. He, you know, he's very, very direct.
Yeah.
Very to the point. He doesn't like to dilly dally. He likes to get it done and get out. But yeah, he was very, very cool. Gave a lot of great answers. And just amazing to have one of the biggest horror directors in the world, you know, sit down with us for a little bit. It was fantastic, you know, because I mean, I'm such a huge fan of his movies too.
Absolutely.
I mean, Prince of Darkness, I saw it in the theater when it was out, and I can't remember how many times I saw that, but also like In the Mouth of Madness, which is something that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, is also one of my favorites to this day. So
it's interesting too, because I didn't even realize this till I watched the Anthrax documentary of their 40th anniversary, that they did the soundtrack for The Ghosts of Mars, which of course is like another Carpenter kind of early 90s forgotten film. Another band, I know Charlie's very much obsessed with horror, as is Scott. You mentioned even the lyrics that he wrote for Anthrax.
Yeah, Scott, he definitely talks about just being influenced by horror and comic books. Stephen King books specifically were really, really inspired him a lot. And Charlie as well. And he's, you know, he loves bands like Ghost, who kind of bring on this horror look. And he talks about the album cover. First Ghost album cover is like the same design as Salem's Lot, right? So
right.
We talk about album covers too. Like a lot, so many album covers are kind of horror artwork, and that's sort of designed to catch a person's eye and say, oh my God, look at that. You know, like the first Iron Maiden album.
Yes.
Scott talks about that as well, being a young guy in a record store, seeing this album cover with Eddie on the cover. And I know you talk a lot about Eddie as well in the doc. But yeah, so we talk about that as well, as like you see this horror imagery on an album cover, which is unusual for the most part. And it makes you just kind of pick it up and kind of take a chance on it. So,
that was a huge thing. You know, basically, I think the crux of this really started in the 80s when, you know, that I still remember Killer's album cover being like terrifying. Like as a kid, it came out in 82. So I was 10 or 11. Like it was creepy. Like you were scared by this thing. Like, oh my gosh, like I don't even know if I want to read this. That one was bad. Hell Awaits was bad because the demon's like some, just pulling this guy's head off and eviscerating him. Like, it's, we're all been so desensitized now in 2021, but in 1984, the heavy metal bands were putting horror on their album covers that literally scared you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember, I think I was in, walking with my parents in downtown Albany when I was a kid, and I saw Eddie for the first time and on the outside of a poster outside of a record store, and I'm like, holy shit, like, what the f-?
Yeah.
Like, that's some creepy shit that you don't, you know, normally see. So yeah, and I remember being a kid, and there would be these commercials for those Kiss dolls, and I remember right. that back in like the late 70s or yeah. something, and those used to freak me out, you know, the Gene Simmons and everything. I saw that as a kid, and I'm like, those are some scary ass toys. Like, I don't know if I'm ready for that yet.
Yeah. Well, it's the famous Kiss Alive 2 album cover where Gene's got the blood out of his mouth. He just looks like this overfed vampiric worm, like blood drunk. That'd be a great name for a horror movie, Blood Drunk. Did you ever try and get Gene? Because he's a huge horror movie fan.
I did. Those are one of the other ones that just didn't work out for whatever yeah. reason. But yeah, I did reach out to him because I know that he's a huge horror guy, and he's been in horror films as well. So
that's right.
Yeah. So would have been a good interview. But yeah, there's just some
you just can't make it happen, right?
Yeah, for whatever reason.
Start to wind down. He had such another great plethora of. You know, we've talked a lot about the metal guys, but you have a lot of great horror movie icons too. And I mean, Gunnar Hansen, who of course was Leatherface, and Kane Hodder, who was probably the most famous of the Jasons. How was that for you talking with them? Because Texas is another of those ones. It came out in 1974 and people kind of gloss over it, but it is one of the most terrifying movies still to this day, along with The Exorcist, along with Halloween. You didn't need CGI characters to freak you out from those characters.
Oh yeah. I mean, and Texas Chainsaw also had that grittiness to it that just made you feel right. kind of sick. And when you hear stories about the filming, how they actually had, you know, live animal organs and stuff
right.
on that table, and they're just baking under the hot lights, and the place stinks, and people throwing up everywhere, and it's just disgusting. When you hear those stories, it makes it even more, you know, terrifying in a way yeah. to think like those aren't just props. Like, those are actually, that's like rotting meat Oof. On the table there with real flies and maggots and stuff. But yeah, we interviewed Gunnar, who played Leatherface, and rest in peace. He, you know, he's another one who
that's
passed
right.
away. But such a nice guy, gave us a great interview. And he was also another guy that wasn't really like a metal fan, but he gave such great answers on why metal and horror worked well together. Cause he understands it. He understands the genre and why people are into it, both for heavy metal and horror. And so we got to interview him at a convention after the show, and he was just the nicest guy. And, you know, he asked us to come hang out and have a beer afterwards. And he said, yeah, I'll be in the lobby later on. Come by and have a beer with us. And unfortunately it never happened. He was a little too tired and stuff, but yeah, such a nice guy. And I do have a picture with him dressed up in the original Leatherface costume with the chainsaw and everything. They did some photo ops at the convention. So that was another great moment. But yeah, Kane Hodder, definitely the most famous Jason out of all of them.
Right.
Just because he was in, he started in Part 7, but he did the most Friday 13th films, and people just, you know, and there are a lot of guys too, like CJ Graham also, who from Part 6. Part 6 was another big one.
Mm-hmm.
CJ's also in the film. But yeah, Kane is such a, like, a fun guy to hang out with. He'll break your balls to no end, but it's very cool. And I have an awesome picture with him choking me in one arm and Kirk Hammett in the other.
Oh.
So that's one of my favorite photos. I love that one. But yeah, these guys are also just down to earth and fun and cool and everything.
It's such a diverse collection of interviewees. How do you, like, okay, so now the ball is rolling. Like you said at first, okay, we got Jericho, we got Kirk. Now we can go get this guy. You look down this cast list and there's, like you said, 60 interviews on here. Where are you kind of swinging from vine to vine too? Just like, well, I'll take this guy. Or people bringing names up? You know who would be good is so-and-so.
Initially, when I first started this, I kind of put a list together of everyone that I'd like to interview. You know, guys who I knew who had some kind of a metal connection, metal artists, horror guys. And then some of it was going through through friends, you know, like Rob Lucas, you know, he knows a lot of these. He's friends with, you know, best friends with Tom Savini, close friends with Doug Bradley and a lot of other people. So he was able to do a lot of the introductions along the way. And then sometimes I would just reach out to an artist manager. You know, I'd find their contact somewhere and I'd just email them and say, hey, I'm doing this project. I'd love to interview so-and-so. So a lot of it came through that as well. And sometimes it would just be going to the convention floor and saying, you know, just kind of looking around saying, hey, it would be good for an interview. And I just go up to the table and say, hey, I'm here for the weekend. I'm going to be shooting up in room whatever. If you have a free 15 minutes, you know, come by. And then we schedule a time slot. So I might come away from a horror convention with maybe three or four.
Gotcha. Interviews.
Yeah. So we just kind of bang it out that way. It's like I'd look at the roster and say, oh, you know, here's a whole list of people that are going to be attending. If I can reach out to them beforehand, you know, I'll do that. But otherwise, if I can't, I'll just kind of meet them on the floor and let them know what I'm up to. So a lot of the interviews happen that way.
I love the Mark Price from Trick or Treat, obviously Skippy from Family Ties. And it's like you see him and he looks almost the same. Obviously, he's older, but it was, you know, you see guys like that in there. It just makes the whole movie more complete.
Yeah, he was a great addition. He was probably the last interview that that I had. I flew out to Ohio. He was doing because he's
stand-up, right? Yeah.
Yeah. He's a stand-up comedian. So I think he was doing a show out there and it was the closest. It was a really short flight for me and he was available. So I flew out to the hotel. We just shot an interview there and he was great because he was in Trick or Treat and Trick or Treat is such a great film to cover for this too, because it also is a film that brings in heavy metal and horror. You know, it's a horror film with a very strong heavy metal element to it. So
obviously Mark Gene and Ozzy are both in it.
Both in it, of course. Yeah. So, yeah. And Mark, I asked Mark if, you know, if the opportunity ever came along to do a sequel, he's like, yes. Without me even finishing the question. He's like, absolutely. So who knows?
He's like, maybe for any movie.
Yeah.
I don't care what it is.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, maybe that's something that can come to fruition at some point too.
When you've been filming for 7 years, when do you know that it's done? Like, because this seems to me that you could pull a Chinese Democracy and tinker with this thing. You know, once it's 7 years, it's like, what's another two? Or I'm going to wait for Ozzy, or I'm going to wait for Gene. Like, when do you finally go, dude, this is what I need. This is done.
7 years is just, it's a long time. And it kind of wearing on me after a while, you know, working on it. And I mean, I started editing immediately. As soon as I got the footage back, I started kind of cutting it up. So we're talking about, you know, a bunch of years doing that. And I was just getting to the point where I just needed to wrap it up. And I was seeing that I just wasn't really getting anywhere as far as getting these other interviews. It just seemed like, how much longer can you really wait? And no one's really giving a definite answer as to, you know, whether or not it's going to happen. It's like, yeah, maybe, maybe not. So I kind of had to put the brakes on and say, all right, you know, it's just, I got to get this thing done because I could wait another 7 years, you know, for someone to become available and it'll never happen. So it just needed to be done. And I just needed to just wrap it up because it was a lot of work. It was kind of wearing on me. And but it was fun. I mean, it wasn't a drag working on, but I want to move on to other things. So.
Well, you want to get it out there too, you know. And that's, you know, I did a documentary last year called I'm Too Old for This Shit, which was more of a story about, you know, it's more of an inspirational heavy metal type story. And we bypassed going to all the different festivals and just actually went straight to iTunes, et cetera. And actually, it's funny. You'll be proud of me. I just got my first check, the Gravitas, which is what I went through, must have recouped because I got my first check for the film yesterday for $1.49.
Nice.
So there you go, guys. There's the realities of the documentary movie making business. But we have recouped, so now I'll start making profit. But you obviously went the other route because I'm looking here of all the film festivals that you've been entered in, all the film festivals that you've won, selected, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's been very, very successful for you. So is that kind of how you do it? Is you go just, you know, winner of Fear Maker of the Year, Horror Fest, Hot Springs International Horror Film Festival, and there's dozens of them on here. So that's been very, very successful for you.
That's been, yeah. I mean, that's something I was really looking forward to. And that's another thing too. It's like you want to jump on that festival circuit at a good time. because it's very easy to run late on that and just miss all these festivals.
You're talking about for like when you release it, then you have to get it in time for the festival's deadline.
Yeah. Cause, and a lot of the festivals happen in the late summer and fall, getting into early winter. So you kind of miss that window. Then you have to wait, you know, kind of another, I mean, there are festivals going on all year, but the bulk of them are really happening now. So once you miss that window, then at that point, you might as well wait another year. But I wanted to jump on that. And it's been great so far. I mean, the film's been shown at different festivals around the country. It's been shown in South Africa. It's been shown in Denmark. It's been getting around. So it's been great. And I got a couple of awards so far. Got Spooky Empire's Fear Maker of the Year, which is a very cool.
I've been to Spooky Empire. That's really cool.
Yeah. So that was great. And I've won awards for best editing, for best documentary.
So when will this be available?
Hopefully, still working on it? Hopefully early next year. I think, I mean, part of the film festival scene is just getting it shown around at different festivals and hopefully getting it seen by different sales agents and distributors. So I've got a few offers so far. I'm still, you know, getting a couple more. And then once I get something I'm really comfortable with, I'll jump on that and then hopefully get a good deal. And then hopefully get it out to all the fans in early 2022.
And like you said, this is quite a process. It's not easy to do. So the fact that you've released it and got all the success so far is great. But last few questions for you. We keep talking about this. Why, in your opinion, does horror and heavy metal mix so well?
I mean, I think if you're just naturally into dark forms of art, you know, if you like dark stories, dark movies, dark music, then you're drawn to both. It's definitely the two genres that go hand in hand. I think just because they're both aggressive in their own kind of way. I mean, metal is aggressive, horror is aggressive, it's dark, it's scary, you know, it's loud. So if you're drawn to those types of themes, then it's very easy to be a fan of both heavy metal and horror.
Yeah, I agree. And like, I think a lot of it is the imagery too, like we discussed. I mean, you can't, there is no, I mean, you know, we didn't even talk about Cannibal Corpse. They kind of went completely down the gore route for their album covers and lyrics. Not that you can understand any of them because it's just one big rah. I love George Corpse Grinder. I always call him the thumb, the human thumb. You put a face on a thumb and that's him. He's got no neck. It's just...
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the funny things too, is that when you see him on stage, you listen to his music. I mean, it just sounds like evil, you know, just pure evil coming out of that throat of his. And then when you sit down with him, it's like he'll talk to you for an hour about comic books and wrestling and you know, just like fun kind of nerdy stuff, you know. And we spent a lot of time with him on the tour bus. At I forgot what music festival was, but yeah, he was such a cool and fun guy.
Cool dude. I guess last question for you: what's your favorite part of the documentary? Is there a certain interview that stands out for you, or a certain moment that you really get a really feel kind of epitomizes what the movie's all about?
Not one thing. I think it's just a combination of everything that's gone into it. Just all the people that I got involved with it, the stories that they tell. I think just to shape this whole story. So. Yeah, there's not one person, there's not one section or anything. It's the combination of everyone coming together to tell the story of metal and horror and, you know, their favorite films, their favorite albums, and, you know, and why they think these genres work well together. And just, having people who were in the films, you know, that we all love and having the people create the music that we all love, you know, having them sit down and have a conversation about all this stuff. I just think it's amazing. And I've just been so fortunate to have been, you know, have all of you involved in this film. And it's been great. So, you know, luckily the reaction so far has been good. And I hope more people get to see it and enjoy it.
Who's your favorite metal band?
Whew, that's a hard one. Fozzy.
Ah, nice.
Yeah, it's with movies, you know, a lot of people ask me what my favorite horror film is, and it's just, it changes. You know, it's like I'll be into something for a while, and then I was like, all right, I saw that, and it's cool, but then I'm kind of moving on to something else. So it really depends. I mean, one more obscure film I talk about is In the Mouth of Madness, like I mentioned earlier, and, you know, music-wise, you know, I like Slipknot. I like Metallica. I like Lamb of God. I mean, it's just, there's just so much so much, too much stuff.
Yeah, there's lots of imagery and all. Well, Mike, it's been good talking to you, man. Like I said, congratulations on this. And it was fun to see the evolution of my look, because I started out with short hair, but then you've put some more in, recent clips of me beating up Naito in New Japan, and there's me doing a signing. I'm like, it's all the hairstyles of Jericho combined into one movie. So even just for that alone, you guys have to watch this movie.
I think we might have some more bonus features on that too. We can kind of, you know, dive a little bit deeper into the looks of Jericho.
I'm wearing like a yellow Wings, Paul McCartney Wings t-shirt with a gray hoodie. I'm like, what was I doing this, Dave? Did you know you were on camera?
Well, it's another reason why I needed to wrap this thing up, because it's like, we're all getting older, and looking at the watching the interviews, like, oh my God, when did you shoot this? It says some people lost weight, some people gained weight, some people grew hair, some people lost hair. So. Yeah.
Well, dude, it's a great job, and like you said, it was a Herculean task that you did really well, and I can't wait for everybody to get a chance to check it out.
Cool, thanks so much. And if everyone's interested, you know, go to metalhorror.com. That's the website, and then social media, of course, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter is at The Metal Horror, and we keep that updated pretty frequently. So maybe we'll be in your town. You can come by and check the film out.
Great stuff, man. Thank you, dude. Beware of giant moths.
Yes. Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man.